We have never agreed for our lands to be invaded or occupied. We have never consented to it, and we will never, ever surrender or compromise. We occupied government buildings, we blockaded highways, and we talked about not just marching, but direct action to shut this shit down.
Here we draw the line. Why here we say no more?
Welcome to Indigenous Action, where we dig deep into critical issues impacting our communities throughout occupied America, or what we call Turtle Island.
This is an autonomous anti-colonial broadcast with unapologetic and claws-out analysis towards total liberation.
So take your seat by this fire, and may the bridges we burn together light our way.
Fuel that fire so it's a blazing, blazing fire that they can never stop.
All right, Yate, it's been a moment, but we are back and reconnecting with y'all. We, as Indigenous Action Podcast, have missed out on a lot of things, so we're going to use this show as an opportunity to dig into some of the issues that we missed and share some space with some awesome guests that Bon will be talking about. But I just want to mention that we are now part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. We're going to hear a promo from one of the shows that's featured this month, and then we're going to get right into it. So welcome back, and we're excited to dig deep and go claws out on some of the shit that we missed out on.
1212, tune in for another episode of Marooncast. Marooncast is a down-to-earth black radical podcast for the people. Our host, hip-hop anarchist Simile the RBG, and sex educator and crochet artist KLC, share their reflections on maroons, rebellions, womanism, life, culture, community, trap liberation, and everyday ratchetness. They deliver fresh commentary with a queer, trans, gender non-conforming, fierce, funny, Southern girls, anti-imperialist, anti-oppression approach. Polyad and bullshit. Check out episodes of Marooncast on Channel Zero Network, Buzzsprout, SoundCloud, Google, Apple, and Spotify. All power to the people, all pleasure to the people. Peace.
Oka, hello everybody. Welcome back. One of your hosts, Bon, and my pronouns are they, them. Really happy to be here with our two amazing guests. Bearcat is here, and she does some really amazing work with Indigenous Mutual Aid and also offers like really critical perspectives on some of the things we're going to talk about today. And same with Remy. He is always really quick to offer perspectives that we can, Indigenous folks kind of build on. So I'm super excited to have both of these guests here today as we kind of get back into the groove of the podcast and having these deep critical conversations that, you know, aren't really happening on other platforms. So we're super excited again to be here and get the ball rolling on these conversations. So thanks, y'all. If you want to maybe give a little introduction and then also offer your pronouns, that would be great.
What's up, y'all? I'm Jen Bearcat. I go by she, her. I come from Northern Nevada. My tribe is Shoshone and Paiute. I've been down here in Albuquerque, New Mexico for about 20 years or so. I came down here for to get away from all kinds of shit at home and ended up going to school forever. but then joining the nonprofit industrial complex until I saw what it was all about. I got out and now I really offer perspective on what because I know from the inside what it looks like. And I know what it means to what it really looks like to change things from the inside out, and how that is not actually possible. So I try to offer my investment in all the years I spent in school with my critical analysis of all the things that's going on.
Remy, Chair. I just want to say thank you for giving me some time here. Really respect a lot of y'all's work, continued work, and just meeting a few of y'all now. My name is Remy. I come from an area known as Black Mesa on the Navajo Reservation. And I do a little bit of art and other media and try and figure out ways to weaponize that against, you know, our oppressors, or at least meet them where they're at, in the sense of, you know, a movement or struggle and whatnot. I just get really tired of the status quo and incremental change. And I think that there's a lot of things that we can do in terms of a diversity of tactics that would make us a lot more successful. I spent about 8 months in Standing Rock and know all these different organizations and things like that, and all of these things that continually hinder us. And we were able to carve out, you know, significant wins against the world's greatest army, if you want to look at it like that. And I think that where we are, I think we need to like criticize and be critical of, you know, some of the people who aren't pushing that narrative, and I'm here to help push that along some way. Yeah.
To start us off, we obviously want to recognize and acknowledge the recent hate crimes committed against our Asian and Pacific Islander, particularly women community, and address really the like interconnectedness of, you know, white supremacy, patriarchy in all its forms, even, you know, other POC patriarchy, and of course purity culture, and really like kind of, you know, like kind of dismantle this like narrative of, around like stopping Asian hate. Whereas we see so much that like victims of white supremacy are always like centered in the media's conversation, and as opposed to centering the issues of white supremacy, you know, whorephobia and this patriarchy. And so we just want to offer our solidarity with Asian and Pacific Islander communities right now. And just make sure that it's very clear that us as Indigenous Action have no tolerance and seek to abolish, you know, white supremacy, patriarchy, and whorephobia. And especially, you know, wanting to draw some of these, like, interconnections between anti-Indigeneity and violence, men's violence against you know, fetishized Asian women, especially as it relates to, you know, these narratives around like comfort women and sex trafficking and, you know, men's violence against sex workers, and of course, using rape as a weapon of war and as a, you know, perpetuation of white supremacy and cis hetero patriarchy. So, yes, many blessings and solidarity with our Asian and Pacific Islander relatives. And I'd love to like hear, you know, if anyone else wants to add to that and really just like wanting to name that, you know, Indigenous sovereignty, it can't really be realized unless we, you know, start to have conversations around the interconnectedness of the violence against white supremacist violence against like all of our communities, and naming that the one thing that's certain is that as long as white supremacy exists, like none of us are safe.
Well, I think that Sometimes it's hard for us as natives to connect with other people's struggles outside of ourselves, because we are on the front lines every day, no matter where we are. And especially when you come from smaller places or more rural places, or even like the reservations, but also even in cities that don't have a very high population of said race or culture. Like I was raised in Reno, and we just didn't have very many Asian people, and the Asian people in our community didn't experience the same like things that other communities were dealing with. Like I didn't even understand that it was even an issue until like I heard it on a Tupac song, when he said, you know, tell the lady at the liquor store that we forgive her, so come home. And then that's when I like looked it up, because you know I love Tupac, but and that's when I started reading up about like the violence that went against like a lot of the Asian community and the gentrification and everything that goes along with it. And I saw that they were being punished for things that they were forced into also. And it's just a really interesting thing to learn about, but we can't learn about it until we understand that it's a thing. And sometimes it's hard to relate as natives because we come from different places. And also we also carry so much trauma ourselves, but it's important that we try to reach out and we try to understand it.
I remember that line, and I interpreted that as the Asian store owner that shot and killed Natasha Harlins, and the tension in the community in that way, and that exploding into the LA riots, and you know, being on the West Coast then, you know, putting all these things together in a way that, you know, I think you were talking about hip hop. This was happening, you know, it's been happening in terms of like the reporting of, you know, white supremacy, you know, all throughout music, all throughout like hip hop, you know, some of the, you know, basic building blocks, you know, have to do with this in terms of like what we're seeing now.
Yeah, I just want to offer that one, we have unconditional solidarity and support for communities who are being assaulted by white supremacists. And so when we say we support Black Lives Matters, when we say Native Justice Now, or when we look towards Asian Pacific Islander communities that are under assault and direct attack by white terrorists, that we will defend our communities and we will be there. We have to make that commitment to show up and support. So we're like, we're all saying the same thing when we're addressing these issues. I take a little bit of issue with the term hate crime, because I think that usually lends itself towards reinforcing the carceral state, like the concept of hate crimes, where they were started, how they are sort of developed as a tool to prosecute certain actions. But the reality is that white supremacy is the underlying issue that we face here. It's a systemic issue that's rooted in colonial oppression. And so the way that, I think this is really, you know, key, looking at the different struggles that we face in our communities, is that white supremacy operates very specifically. We need to name that system of oppression, look at the ways that it insidiously has created this system and based itself on that platform, and ways that we can engage not only to defend, but attack, dismantle, and abolish white supremacy. So I think that that's part of the, you know, position that I'm interested in coming out of it, because, you know, and there are calls from radical Asian Pacific Islander crews that are saying, yeah, we don't want more policing in our communities. We don't want to reinforce the carceral state. You know, we want to even challenge the notion of this being a hate crime, but recognize it for what it is. And I think the second part, which is really important, you know, addressing the horophobia issues, is that you know, I've heard some other commentaries where we can't assume, or we shouldn't assume that folks here were sex workers, but I think it's a very important opportunity to address this dynamic and the specific way that, you know, women from this community have been targeted on multiple levels. And I just want to personally assert and just make it clear that sex work is work. First and foremost, that we recognize the way that sexism, sexist oppression operates, that the industry and systems of exploitation occur. But this is survival, and folks have legitimate ways and means of surviving.
Yeah, of course, like we would never want to assume, you know, the occupation of anyone that is especially like targeted by white supremacy. And I think it's important to note that this was like a sexualized, motivated mass murder, in so much that, like, you know, the murderer said that he wanted to eliminate, he's a sex addict and wanted to eliminate temptations. So yeah, just going off what you're saying, Klee, it's a really important opportunity to address some of the issues that exist around, like the hatred and also simultaneous obsession with Asian sex workers.
I just wanted to say that for some people that are joining in that are new to this, that haven't really developed really their entire, I guess, mindset on how they're going to think about things. Sometimes I don't think it's talked about enough in you know, ever, that the fact that rape or any kind of rape culture is not what you would find in a regular person or a normal, healthy functioning human being. It is actually, it is not the act of sex itself. It is the act of power. Like, they could pay a sex worker if they just wanted to get it, you know? But it's not what they want. They want sex from somebody that's unwilling, and that's the point of it. And so when we tie that back into the struggle, it ties in very closely to MMIW. I've heard it time and time again that a lot of the sex traffickers like Native women because we could pass off as very diverse. We could look Asian. We could present Mexican. We could present this or that. That's what they think. And so when they're advertising us, our women, our sisters, they find that we're very flexible in that. And so we need to also look out for everyone else too, because whatever happens to them is going to happen to us. And we should, that's all of our cultures tell us that. All of our nations, our elders tell us that.
Right. It's kind of like going off that idea that somehow, like, you know, women or femme bodies are the problem, when really the problem is obviously, like we've said, you know, white supremacy and toxic patriarchy. And just like the, you know, the past 500 plus years of using, you know, women and femmes bodies as like a mechanism of colonialism and war against our peoples. So thanks for adding that.
Yeah, I think a lot of our brothers get kind of freaked out when we talk about this stuff, because they don't think that way. And so they don't have any idea what it is to think that way. And so they think that they're going to be judged on that same scale. But no, women, we walk with this every day, and we know a threat when we see a threat. And so if you're strong enough that we can call you a brother, that means that we don't see that threat in you. And that means... and if you have a question about something, or if you feel like, am I fucking up, or if you're wondering, just ask us. Like, come and ask us. That's what we're here for.
But also, like, take responsibility for learning this shit on your own, because I cannot tell you how many times, like, you know, the most like yeah, I hate to say it, but like basic questioning comes up, and I'm just kind of like, bro, like, do your fucking homework. And then
you tell them straight up, though, because if you tell them straight up, they won't come ask again.
And you know what? Maybe I'm just not the person that they need to come to ask, because, you know, I, like, we have shit out on Indigenous Action for like calls to action for men, like a whole list of things that like they can do. They need to like, you know, come collect them. They need to collect themselves first and then they can.
Yeah. I'm not saying like hold too much space. I'm not saying that. I definitely a high bar, but,
yes,
but also if you're willing to work and we see that, then yes. But yes, that is a very good point because I don't play all that whole fake fucking fake playing dumb bullshit that they do sometimes. A lot of times, most of the time.
Yeah, and then just think, you know, kind of like name that as unintended sexism, mm-hmm. or you know something like that, and it's kind of like
fragile ass out of here.
Yes, thank you.
All right. Good evening.
All right. Well. So, yeah, I think that maybe we can also use this as an opportunity, you know, as we said, we're kind of like coming back to getting in a routine and with the podcast. So a lot has happened, I'm sure, in each of our lives since we've all been able to come be, you know, on the mic. And so we want to use the next couple minutes or so just to give any personal updates. I certainly have one of my own, so I'll just go ahead and start. As some folks might know, I organize with a crew of folks called Skuya Mobile Unit, and we do nightly patrols out here in so-called Flagstaff. And you know, one night one of our crew members had witnessed a unsheltered relative just be completely brutalized by the cops. And, you know, for a lot of us, that's nothing new. But it was still extremely, you know, like traumatizing. And so, of course, we organized, a rally against the continued police brutality that we've been, you know, seeing here in so-called Flagstaff for so long. And it actually ended up being like really great. There was a lot of people who came out. I think people in here in so-called Flagstaff have really been like waiting for an opportunity to like get back out and do some direct action because we hadn't had anything. Gosh, I think since the Indigenous People's Day of Rage, we had made attempts, which again was amazing. And we had an attempt to actually like rally after the election. And God, I think there were probably like three cops to each person who had showed up. So obviously that was not a safe situation for anyone. So since then, this is the first, organized, Indigenous-led, organized, direct action that folks wanted to stand in solidarity with this man who was just attacked by the police. And so knowing that we had been doing like outreach every night specifically towards our relatives who we would meet out on patrol, so we knew that there would be relatives in attendance. And knowing that it was going to be a very cold evening, we had set up and organized for folks to give relatives rides to either the shelter or some of the hotels that we reserved in preparation for that night. And so I was walking. Some relatives over to a vehicle and to coordinate ride to hotel. And I just basically got snatched by the police officers. This is the repeating pattern that they've displayed here in so-called Flagstaff. They'll wait for a protest to end and so and not make an arrest during so that they can, you know, supposedly like maintain peace. But really what it is in targeting of indigenous led organizers here in so-called Flagstaff. And I also want to mention that anytime a protest or an action has anything to do with like indigenous specific calls for abolishment of the police and the white settler colonial state, like the police come out in full force. There was a whole tactical unit up on a roof near where we met and just lots of police presence there. So it's just like very clear targeting. I also want to mention that in one of the police reports, the undercover motherfucker who, you know, alleges that I threw a water bottle at a police officer and I hit him in the back of the head. That's the alleging that, gave them probable cause to arrest me. Anyway, he specifically in the report mentions that there was an African American woman who seemed to have been part of the organizing of this rally. And there were like multiple, it wasn't just like there were black kin who showed up in solidarity for our struggles and our interconnected struggles. And so obviously like just wanting to mention just like another like clear racially anti-black motivated alleging of violence against a fucking police officer, and so that happened to me. That was like on the 27th last month, and actually 4 months prior to that I was arrested for another targeting of it was basically a racial profiling situation where we had just, me and some buddies were just driving by a MAGA protest, where someone had happened to allegedly throw eggs at, these, fascist white supremacist piece of fucking shit who were rallying outside.
Some anti-fascist heroes allegedly threw eggs.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's be clear.
Yes. some badass anti-fascist heroes allegedly disrupted this rallying around this piece of shit, and so we drove by, and since the driver was clearly an indigenous femme, we got pulled over and accused of allegedly being the ones to throw these eggs that hit a police officer. And while we were being detained based on these like false accusations, the police officer goes, "How would you feel if somebody threw an egg at your car?" And so obviously just wanted to make an arrest because their fragile fascist egos couldn't, possibly stand not inflicting violence and punishment against indigenous femmes in a moment where eggs were thrown at their vehicle. So
allegedly. Like
the state. Yes, allegedly.
They really think a lot of your threats abilities though.
So how can people support you with this, these charges, facing these charges?
Yeah, so we're Flagstaff Anti-Repression Force is currently like creating a campaign around how to support and get these charges dropped. We're still in the process of disseminating all of our calls to action. Right now, what you can do is contribute to my legal defense, and you can do that by, probably the easiest way to direct people to that GoFundMe is just by going onto my Instagram bio where it's linked, and also it's also linked to the Indigenous Action Instagram bio. So my Instagram handle is Bonabella, BONNABELLA.XVX, and then of course hopefully all of y'all are already following Indigenous Action, so it's there too. And we'll be creating a link tree to put out different call outs for support on that. So that's my personal update of what's been going on over the past, 6 months or so since we've been able to get on the mic. So yeah, anyone else want to add in an update for everybody?
I just want to link that to the reality that many folks have been facing as far as state repression in relation to like the powerful uprisings for Black Lives Matters and a range of other mobilizations that have been happening during the fascist Trump era and now, the Biden administration, and that those escalations, those attacks have not ceased and those court cases are still being prosecuted. So, particularly one case that we've been trying to also highlight is the case of Lauren Reed, who's Diné from the so-called Page area, which is just north of here in so-called Flagstaff, northern Arizona. And just as a real quick synopsis, back in July, he was part of a crew that was planning a mobilization to support the George Floyd uprising and against police violence. And what had happened was that he had a private chat on Facebook and some folks were talking about pretty sort of sensational actions. They were sort of joking about some stuff and the FBI targeted him and now he's facing federal charges. He's been in pretrial detainment since July in federal holding. And this is a case that's really critical because these are private Facebook messages that the cops infiltrated. And the FBI uses a pretext to attack him. They had a SWAT-style arrest. He was tased, and then he's been in jail since. So there's a range of ways that folks can support him. Again, check out our site, indigenousaction.org. You can also check out the Tucson anti-state repression crew as well.
Well, it's been a pretty busy spring for me. As always, working on mutual aid. For the community, we did two major distributions that we were able to do. And luckily it came right before a weekend that we had an unexpected snowstorm, or I guess cold front come in. And so we were able to disperse like a ton of warm weather gear in on the day of last minute preparation. I'm very happy with the way that our mutual aid networks here in Albuquerque work. They really, really showed up. I brought it in and within 24 hours, not even 24 hours, everything was out the door, and within 72 hours, everything was on the streets. So that is a good thing. And that's a lot of bulk to move. But, I went out there on the streets and I checked and I talked to people, and just by watching everything that was going on, I drove down Central and hopped the bus, and I saw the black backpacks, I saw the black face masks and our blankets and things all up and down Central. So that lets me know that the things are getting to where they need to go, and our mutual aid groups are actually doing what they say they're doing, and that means a lot. It means a lot for them to show up. So I'd like to say thank you to them. And as far as future plans, there is a lithium mine that's being proposed in northern Nevada at Thacker Pass. There is presently a camp set up there. It's a camp set up by two, I guess, allies. I don't know them personally. I can't vouch for them, but there's just some things that we've seen that, we're always cautious about things, especially, post Standing Rock and all the stuff that we've seen up there. And with all the NGOs and nonprofits and just knowing how they work and makes us kind of be a little bit more cautious, but we hope not to be too overly cautious where the fact that, where we end up pushing away a good help, because we are going to need help on this. And looking into all of the, all the executive orders and things, which I've been doing this last week, looking into all the executive orders that Trump pushed and how it's going to impact us on this battle right now. A lot of it has to do with the Department of the Interior, and that's your Auntie Deb. Fucking talk to your Auntie Deb, and you better tell her. Call off her dogs. You know, like we're all out there at the pipelines. We're all out there. MMIW, we're all out there doing this and doing that. Well, now we got a Native woman. You guys are so proud of her, you know, to say that we finally got a Native in there. Well, what good is a Native in there if they're not going to actually do something? And right now we need it. So I encourage you to all hit her up. I don't know what kind of connection you have with her. I know a lot of people that have direct connection with her. Hit her up and tell her. And I mean, honestly, I hope you prove me wrong. I hope when I say like she ain't gonna do shit for us, she's gonna double cross us. She's a scout. I hope you prove me wrong. Prove me wrong.
Yes. So since our last podcast episode 6 in December, we missed sort of like 3 particularly important political moments: 1, the Biden election; 2, the Capitol storming; and 3, I think as far as Indigenous communities are concerned, the Holland confirmation. So we wanted to sort of like get y'all's perspectives on these issues. We're not going to have as much time to dig as deep as I think as we'd like, but from Indigenous action standpoint, we did publish some stuff. Actually, interestingly enough, we published something that got censored repeatedly and almost got us banned from social media, critiquing Biden, particularly around the election time. It was just like centered around an image with arrows stuck into Biden as an anti-neoliberal, anti-colonial statement that was paired with the statement that we wrote. You can check out on our website. That's just basically 16 things that you can do to be ungovernable in the face of the Biden administration. So we basically were just sort of addressing the reality that it's the same same politics, but just a new administration, because the underlying systems of oppression that this U.S. imperialist force is based upon haven't changed with any election, and something that we've been critiquing for a long time. So it's just interesting to see like how immediately, even though we've had for what four plus years, an image of Trump with like the same arrows, we just interchange that with Biden. And then that immediately is what gets us just about banned as like, you know, encouraging political violence or something. So it's just like showing an interesting sort of bullshit op that's going on with social media, but of course we don't rely on that.
So I have a similar story in the sense that I posted something that said overturn cop car, like, you know, Trump wins, we riot. And that said, like, I posted another one that said, you know, if Biden wins, we riot. And another one that said whoever wins is riot. And it was the Biden one that kept continually getting like flagged and everything like that. And so I was in a little bit of the same boat. And it was pretty funny because I don't know what the post was pertaining to. I kept getting this alert for election coverage and everything like that. And he's like, if you want to look at election results. And so that mixed with the meme itself was actually pretty funny. In general.
Yeah, and we've seen that as a trend, right? Like there's been a systematic censorship of radical accounts, particularly on Facebook and on Instagram, which is owned by Facebook, where they've gone after like Crime Think, they've gone after, I think It's Going Down, they've gone after a range of particularly anarchist accounts, and they've threatened a range of other ones as well. And so that was like part of that whole trend or tendency that we saw, and something that hasn't obviously shifted with the transition of administrations. So yeah, I just like as something that we sort of missed, I don't know if you want to just like address anything for our audience regarding the election, the the siege of the Capitol, as some people were calling it, a quote unquote insurrection. Maybe we can hit those two points first to then get into the Holland confirmation.
Yeah, sure. You know, I really don't have that much commentary on it other than folks should definitely listen to the voting podcast that we recorded. I think it was one of the first ones that we recorded. And pretty much everything that we've already said and predicted is what's happening now. So not too much to add there. But, you know, it's, you know, and just kind of drawing connection to, you know, what's happening, the violence that's happening against our API community. you know, the day that these women were murdered, you know, he released a statement, you know, saying, you know, we stand against hate towards our, you know, Asian community. And then, you know, the night before had deported 32 Vietnamese folks. So just always keep in mind, everybody, that these politicians are just like, you know, on no matter what party line they're on, they're just like all full of shit. And so just obviously don't believe anything that they fucking say.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this is a colonial institution that was enforced upon us. And so, yeah, I don't believe in any type of voting or anything like that. I think it's already been said probably many times on this, you know, podcast and through our various different media that we, you know, put out. So, you know, this thing is what it is, and it's going to be the way it's going to be because of the way it's been set up. And, you know, when you have institutions like police and everything like that that enforce that, I think that, you know, we have to really look at some of these, you know, institutions. Are they necessary? You know, because we had it dialed in on this on this land before ships landed on our shores. We never needed, like, a political structure in some way that was, you know, required all these different, you know, colonial manifesto. We didn't have a need for police. You know, we solved everything internally. We handled these things. And I think that, you know, getting away from that particular our beginnings, or, you know, the way we had things, I think, you know, the further we get away from that, the worse off that we are.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like Biden framed himself as the restorer of quote-unquote normalcy, under which we were being killed, assaulted, disappeared, bombed, polluted, incarcerated, impoverished, and desecrated. Like, so a return to neoliberal norm is a return to death for our communities throughout the world. And part of what was really frustrating, but also not surprising, was the reaction from liberals who were, you know, very much gung-ho anti-fascist against the authoritarian nationalism of Trump, then, you know, turning around and suppressing and silencing the critiques and analysis of radicals regarding the Biden administration and the transition. And so I think this is a really critical time to address that still. I highly recommend, if anybody's interested, checking out our website, indigenousaction.org, for those 16 points that we made regarding ungovernability with this transition of administrations. But I know you already shared a bit, Bearcat, but I want to hear more about your thoughts regarding the siege at the Capitol and also this transition of administrations.
I feel like a lot of our communities, Native communities, I feel like we think that things are either res or city, you know, rural or urban. And so when we talk about things like these ideas, and I feel like it's the terminology a lot of times that throws people. And they don't realize that we've already been doing it, that they, like anarchists and all of this political stuff, they actually, they were looking for a better way, a perfect way, a more perfect way, I guess you could say. And they actually came over here to study our societies and our people. And so, you know, that's where the term mutual aid even came from, is they came over here and viewed, but they viewed through their westernize their white people eyes, you know, and that's how they transcribed it. So it's a start, and it's a good way to bridge it back. But I also, as I've been organizing more in our on the reservations, I hear a lot of people, like so many people from the res, talk about, oh, that'll never happen. Oh, nobody's going to do that. Oh, that's not possible. And I just tell them, like, oh, it's not possible. How come we're doing it right here? How come these people are doing it right there? I feel like a lot of our communities are so, they've been so separated for a long time that people still assume it's the same like that, but it's not. We have communities rising and doing these things and putting everything that Klee just said into action on the res, on every front line, in the cities. These actions work, period.
I just want to reiterate, since we're talking about, you know, Biden and you know, like, you know, this colonial project, that you know, that operates in, is that, like, all the things that Bearcat just mentioned are things that will never happen and will never be achieved through collaborating or working within that system. So just always, like, you know, never forget to recognize, like, our own autonomy outside of those systems that we're so brainwashed into believing we can somehow get to work to the benefit of Black, Indigenous, people of color, you know, our Asian, Pacific Islander relatives as well. So never be fooled that we will ever be offered any kind of, you know, critical support by those institutions, including the nonprofit industrial complex.
And Remy, I'm curious as to your take on the Capitol storming. We haven't had a chance to talk, I think, specifically about that. So I'm curious if you had any particular thoughts on how that relates to, you know, the responses of the state to Indigenous resistance as well.
In terms of the Capitol storming, I think that what you saw was the failure, not the failure, that thing was planned, but the breakdown of, like, where a lot of people really just weren't ready to face their, you know, the privilege that, you know, the white skin, white people have and everything like that, you know, to be able to do something like that. If there was any person of color, you know, maybe if you've been down that area, you can't go within like 2-3 blocks without like somebody like barking at you, possibly wanting to pull a gun on you just to flex, you know? And so the fact that like all these things were set up in that way on that day, if you look at this from a tactical standpoint, everything was set up correctly. You know, you had breakdowns in key areas that I think were really critical to the overall success of what you saw. And to say that that wasn't planned or anything like that, it's ridiculous. So, you know, if we could get some white people to do that, you know, for us, I think that, like, you know, we'd be in a lot better place. And I think it's up to white people for themselves to really look at, like, a lot of these things that we've been saying for, you know, hundreds of years in some cases. You know, so, you know, when I look at that, I just kind of see that, you know, I was very entertained. I was like, right, you know, getting everything set up to have some snacks, and I was like, all right, you know, get my popcorn popped, and let's go with this. It was good. So, in that way, but, yeah, a lot of learning, elements. I think, yeah, the unfortunate part of that is that these people are starting to learn too, in the sense of organizing and everything like that. What I'm talking about is like the racists, the white supremacists. You see them going, things that, you know, we've been doing tactically, some of the things that we've been doing, as a movement, some of, I guess, the more serious folks, you know, we have encrypted channels. We do these things. And so it's been unfortunate to see that in a way, you know, also escalate. But, you know, we just got to keep moving, be a step ahead of them and, you know, watching everything with a critical eye. And so that's my take on it.
I think that I agree. Well, actually, I was happy when I saw that shit going down. I was like, yeah, fucking take it. You know why? Because it doesn't matter to me what their intention was going in, because they got into spaces that we couldn't get into. And for the long run, I don't care who burns it down as long as it burns. That's just my take personally. The part that I was concerned about was the fact that this could be actually, they really could have sent in actors to so that they could perform, and then they could set, as we've seen that they like with the Patriot Act, they say it's for one thing. They say, oh, we have to worry about terrorism. Look, everybody, terrorism. And then they make new laws and pass new things specifically dealing with terrorism. But then when we were at Standing Rock, boom, they labeled us terrorists. So they were able to do all of those things that they had designated for quote unquote terrorists. They were able to weaponize that against us. And it's like, I'm not a terrorist. So I might be a terror, but I'm not a terrorist, you know? But I thought that was just one thing that we needed to watch for, because that's how they slide things through. They're sneaky like that.
Yeah, we published a piece right after that called Gasoline on the Fire, The Strategic Opportunity of Settler-on-Settler Violence, which is also available on our website. Without getting too much into the text of that, I highly recommend people just reading that. But the main thing is that we... we critique this sort of like call for a peaceful transition of power, because there's never been anything peaceful. It assumes that there's been something peaceful or can be something peaceful about U.S. imperialism and how its power functions. And I think like what you brought up, Remy, is really key. Fascists were emboldened. They saw this as a victory, part of their call, which was, the call that one Trump had been playing with fire on with his authoritarian nationalist politics and his rhetoric for years. And that was the culmination of that call. So the January 6th actions, from our perspectives, we saw as a self-inflicted wound. And as we stated, one of many acts in the death pact that we see as the colonial project of what they call America. And we just sort of like, our analysis was that this is an exceptional attack on democracy, but the live stream slip and slide of a social order established on violence against BIPOC bodies and the land and non-human beings. So it's more or less coming full circle, or as some other folks said, the justice sort of roosting chickens. But I think that... the comparisons, we critique this because a lot of folks were like, well, if this was BIPOC folks, we would have been executed right away. But, that the state has been casual about policing a white settler-led riot and heavy-handed when BIPOC communities resist and rise up is an argument that we asserted in the piece, the critique that we had, that exists to validate liberal feelings. It's like, oh, see how bad the state is? Like, see how white supremacist they are? We got you. This is the evidence that we needed. But, for us, it's like, that has been evident for our whole existence. So it's not at all a radical charge to state what has been obvious for indigenous communities since 1492 in these lands. This is how the state functions. It benefits white supremacy. And that's why when we can connect this to the police response, right, of the attacks of the Asian Pacific Islander community right now, the massage parlors, where they're saying that, oh, their white boy had a bad day. Like, fuck that rhetoric. But that's the same power that's at play, right? That's the same institutionalized white supremacy that is at play, saying, with that soft hand. But that's no surprise, because that's the hand that is still attached to the overall apparatus, the body of white supremacist oppression, cis-heteropatriarchy that this system is rooted upon. So our analysis was that, again, pour gasoline on the fire. It's like, yeah, we're going to watch this shit burn. Just sort of like what you said, regardless of who started that fire, the question is what will come from those ruins. And so the idea is that, like, you know, this is the strategy of Rune, and it's the natural trajectory of empires. There's a tendency, as we stated in the response, there's a tendency towards ash for those who play with fire. And although the flames engulfing this empire were not set by our hands, we'll be pouring gasoline and fanning these flames. So it's a bit of an accelerationist, right, position, where we're calling for the strategic interventions to, you know, hit this empire when it is most vulnerable. And so we're more interested in concerned with organizing collective defense and building our own capabilities and infrastructure for conflict. And this is a proposition of survival, liberation, and renewal, so long as it's grounded in actions that restore indigenous autonomy, black reparations, and centers queer, trans, and two-spirit BIPOC forces. And furthermore, so long as it's decentralized, anti-authoritarian, and fiercely intersectional. And that's key because, like, you know, we see, like, what's the nonprofit response to this, right? It's like they were celebrating the vote, and now they're celebrating the Halland confirmation. And I think, you know, maybe this is a good segue, but, you know, I think our communities have been desperate for good news, a reprieve from, one, the disproportionate impacts of COVID-19, and two, the shitty realities that we faced by disproportionately being impacted, of course, by under the Trump administration's policies that were pretty much wholesale resource colonialism. But I think, like, you know, part of my skepticism, and I want to hear more from y'all, and I know you already stated your position, Jen, regarding Halland a bit. And maybe we can tie this into the way that these nonprofits were operating, because they were all about, right? Like, and this is like the weird shit that I get from, like, a lot of these indigenous social media accounts that, on one hand, they seem really radical or woke. They're putting out all this decolonial shit.
Nope.
But then all of a sudden they're like, oh, get out the vote. And then all of a sudden they're like, they're cheerleading the Halland confirmation. And so, like, let's talk about that. Let's see where you're all at with that and tie it into the storming of the Capitol and this political shit show that we're facing.
I found it really interesting that people kept bringing up how Deb was at camp. Oh, Deb went to camp. Auntie Deb is at camp. AOC went to camp. Oh, they're all water protectors. First of all, water protector is not even that's not even a title. First of all, that's already built into our responsibility as people. That's not, we don't get extra points for doing what we're supposed to do. But now we see where that's headed. Look where it's headed. Your Auntie Deb has all the power to proclaim. She signs off on that shit. She signed off on that lithium mine that's going up in Nevada. She signed off. She could pull her BIA and BLM dogs out. They wouldn't be chasing us. She has that power. Mm-hmm. And now.
Yeah, and I think maybe we can, like, kind of frame this part of the conversation around a question that was submitted by Bellingham Alternative Library. They asked, basically, you know, if we had plans to discuss, like, assimilation as a counterinsurgency tactic, and they had referenced a post about Deb Halland serving the state and critiquing the notion of representation. So thanks for submitting that question. Glad that people are reaching out and we have this platform to discuss these things, because that's really important. And I think that's what, you know, Clea was mentioning it in terms of, you know, indigenous communities really just wanted, like, some kind of glimmer of I guess you could call it hope, but, you know, we all know it's false hope. We all know that's, like, you know, not hope rooted in life ways back, because we're never going to see, no matter how many indigenous people take these seats in this colonial project, true autonomy and sovereignty over the caretaking of our ancestral lands. And so, like the part about this that I think is frustrating, that it comes up so often around representational politics, is that, like, we have you know, tribal governments that are where each seat and delegation is occupied by an Indigenous person. And to what extent do we see, you know, an assimilated government that's represented by Indigenous people helping us in any way? And in terms of like what I've seen and what I've experienced is that these puppet governments operating under, you know, a colonial assimilation do nothing to little to actually even more damaging things for our Indigenous communities. So that's just kind of like where maybe we can start that conversation. And so what other things can people really to add to that and bringing that critical analysis to this conversation?
Well, I think that in terms of Deb Haaland or any Indigenous person in positions of a colonial structure, I think whether that be a government or a nonprofit, we're just looking at, you know, now our oppression has a brown face. And so when you have the merging of the corporations and state, these things, you know, we see how politicians, we see how like nonprofits, they go back and forth or whatever these corporations are. And so in terms of Indigenous people being in government or nonprofits, I think we said it before, y'all should be working yourself out of a job, like straight up. I mean, if you're if you think about it, well, what are they getting paid? 35, maybe more, times however many employees? That's hundreds of thousands of dollars. Like, really, I don't know, that's not going to the community. Community doesn't get that. And so I think that, you know, it's really important to be critical of these things, of these institutions that uphold the colonial power or uplift it. So natives, like, get out the vote or anything like that. Voting is sacred. That's trash. That's trash. I mean, how dare you, like, you know, when's the last time you were in ceremony that, like, you know, the medicine person was like, yo, hey, be sure and step in that ballot box and, you know, it ain't going to happen. So, I don't know, I'm just really tired of all these nonprofits propping up these things. Or, you know, they might say that, like, hey, you know, we're great that she's a part of this thing, but, you know, let's look at the stance on the Freeman, you know. What's up with that? You know, we still got to address that. So I think we need to be, like, criticizing these things in real time. And, you know, for folks that don't have a big platform and see these things, maybe that's a call for us to, you know, be in solidarity with each other in some way and, like, you know, join. Because, you know, nonprofit or the government's not going to save us. You know, never has, you know. So again, I go back to, like, what did our ancestors do? They didn't have any of these institutions. So, you know, they had it dialed in. The closer we can get to that, I think the better off that we are. And having a brown face in a colonial racist structure that was benefits, you know, white men, you know, where does that get us?
Yeah, and just real quick for folks who aren't aware, in 2019, while Haaland was seated in Congress, they co-sponsored a bipartisan bill to reauthorize the Native American Housing Assistance and Self-Determination Act through 2024. And that specific bill removed protections for the freedmen of the so-called five civilized Cherokee tribes including Cherokee that had previously been included in bills reauthorizing the fund. So this was viewed as an anti-black attack or an anti-Afro-Indigenous attack on a community that has already been systematically marginalized by and disenrolled by their own peoples. And so just removing that protection was seen as a serious misstep that Holland hasn't really been held accountable to. And so I know some of the Cherokee freedmen are still calling for accountability and trying to find ways to work with Holland because they know they're not going anywhere. But that's a serious fight that needs to be accounted for. And I think that that's a critical issue among a few other ones that Holland was responsible for while they were a member of Congress before their confirmation.
I was very disappointed when, I guess my first disappointment with her would be when she chose to go, well, there was an opportunity for her to go to Palestine or Israel to, I guess, learn about the culture there, or I'm not sure what it was, but it was when she was, it was about 3 years ago when she was serving our district here in Albuquerque, but she chose to go to Israel, and it's like, what the fuck, man? We stand in solidarity with Palestine because they are indigenous. They are indigenous cultures, and they stood with us. More than that, they stood with us. They literally came out and stood with us at Standing Rock. They came over here, and they educated us. They took the time to tell us our struggles are the same. Their water is under the same attack that our water is. And then she goes and does that? Come on. Who does that? Devala does it.
Yeah, I wanted to mention, like, just about what you said, Bearcat, regarding people, one, using, like, hey, I was at Standing Rock. I always think about that meme. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you saw it, where it's just like, anytime somebody says that they're at Standing Rock, remember this person was there too. And it shows a picture of this white hippie, like, totally appropriative, like, poster boy for, you know, cultural appropriation that was probably at Sacred Stone Camp. So it's just, like, always that thing. It's just like, oh, yeah, you were at Standing Rock, but remember, this person was, too. So
It's not, like, some kind of badge of honor
Well, it's a question of, like, commitment and, like, what your role was. There's a lot of people doing different roles and had different levels of their commitment and actually what they were doing there. And what, you know, doesn't mean that everybody who was there is, like, deeply committed to liberation struggles and protection of sacred places. It's a question of what conditions that they had, perhaps, as part of that. And I think that's an important indictment. You know, not everybody should just be wearing that as a badge. Like, yeah, I went to Standing Rock and that's it. It's like so many people did. And some people even were there casually and they've written books about it. So I don't know.
Exactly. Yeah. I feel like anybody that's ever used it in that form as an excuse or as a pass, they were not there for the real, they were there for exploitive reasons. Mm-hmm. Because the rest of the people that were there, like long-term, that were actually down as fuck and, you know, came when they could, but did whatever they could, contributed whatever they could, and really sacrificed. They those are never the people that ever pull that pass out or try to play that. Oh, yeah. No, fuck that. Yeah, because you know what? We're vested.
It's resume building, clout chasing, social capital, you know, investing bullshit that really has no place in the struggle because that's not why we're here.
It's movement hopping, too.
It's really unfortunate because we do need resources. We do appreciate the people that can give whatever they can give, the people that can come out on the weekends, come out, because those are the people that recharge our energies on the weekend. But, you know, don't be using it as a pass. That's all I'm saying.
So the question is about, how can we further discuss assimilation as a counterinsurgency tactic? And how does that relate to the Holland thing? Because we made a post early on when Biden tapped Holland as a nomination for the Secretary of Interior. And we basically were just sort of identifying that, you know, there have been many collaborators with U.S. colonial power in the past from indigenous communities. And that is assimilation tactic that has been used to control our communities. And that dynamic, we don't see any different than what's happening with Holland. So there's a lot of folks, as you know, as you mentioned, Bond, that are sort of hopeful, right? That they're looking for, like, the bright side, that this could mean that, you know, just by having an indigenous person there, that good things may come out of that, like good actions, decisions will be made and help inform and direct the agency of the Bureau of Indian Affairs and so forth that are under the Department of Interior to do better things for our communities. So we're more skeptical than that, though. And the position that I have is, one, you know, we can't expect one person to go into this office and undo a legacy that is violence for hundreds of years. The particularly the establishment of the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the the Department of the Interior is one of war against Indigenous peoples, of violence against Indigenous peoples, used specifically to annihilate our peoples. So to expect one person to go in there and change all that, I think is extraordinarily misplaced optimism. And I think that enthusiasm is completely misplaced. I think we should be basically putting the burden of proof on people who aspire to those political positions of power to demonstrate that they're doing something otherwise. But I'm a skeptic because, you know, the appointments for these positions in these agencies are one that these people are expected to uphold the policies of these administrations. It's not like Holland is going to be acting on their own, right? It's not like they're going to be just signing, you know, blocking permits or whatever. I mean, and they most likely will do some damage control, right? They, for whatever power that they can utilize. But ultimately, if this administration is at odds with any of the people that they've appointed, they will make a change for that. And this administration is rooted in invested in maintaining white supremacy, resource colonialism that powers this empire. And we can't ignore that, why it is established, why it has been found in the first place. You know, it's like people don't, you know, they want to elevate Holland above critique. And that's not acceptable. We should scrutinize people who are put in these positions even more so, because we have had Indian scouts before. You know, our people have been co-opted. And I think the question about assimilation as a counterinsurgency tactic, you know, to me, it's assimilation as a tactic of genocide. It's not just counterinsurgency that we need to frame it and understand it as, is a tactic of genocide. How has those who are seeking to inflict violence on our communities, how have they used our own people against them to legitimize their violence? And that's what happens when we uncritically celebrate, you know, our people being put in these positions. And the extension of the analysis should go into the way that people were like, well, we just need a Native American president. That would fix everything. But the issue is systemic. So like part of the pushback, some of the critiques on our Instagram account, specifically when we were addressing the Holland issue, was that what would we rather see, a white industry lobbyist be in that position? I'm curious as to what y'all's response is to that point. And then also just like further discussing assimilation and counterinsurgency.
I think that, you know, it's important to recognize that this tactic of damage control is, it's not, you know, autonomy, it's not sovereignty, it's not land back. And so it's never going to, it's just an extension of the nonprofit industrial complex when we get into conversations around representation and assimilation. These institutions, these representations are not going to satisfy the demands that we have, you know, been fighting for the last 540 some years. So again, I just will reiterate, there's no reason for hoping or for choosing one oppressor over the other. And why would we put energy and the flames in our hearts to think that this would ever gain us like the things that we've been asking for, not even fucking asking for, that are rightfully fucking ours for centuries now. And so I think that people need to recognize that for what it is. It's not a step in the right direction. It's literally just you know, just damage control or you know, what people would maybe say is harm reduction, which is, again, a co-optation of actual radical, you know, movement making. And so, yeah, those are just some more of my thoughts on the idea of representation or assimilation as a counterinsurgency tactic. I guess in short, I really don't think like representation or assimilation is a viable tactic in our counterinsurgency. So no to that.
One of the things that I saw brought up on the Indigenous Action page, one of the comments I saw, or I guess the arguments, when we did call her out as a scout, because, you know, that is an appropriate label. Somebody brought up the issue, well, you know, you're contributing to MMIW, you're putting a target on her back, you're labeling her this and the label of that. You know what? No. Because think about it. Think about if she does right by the United States as in office, you know, then we all see it, right? Her people, her own people will turn against her. How do you think that's going to affect her? And on the opposite side, if she goes against the U.S. and goes for us, then she puts a target on her own back. So she's fucked either way, right? And we say these things, but if it comes down to it, yes, I will, you know, stand up if she does need protection and our communities need to provide that for her, which is a very real thing that we need to think about, because anytime any of our people go into these areas, it's very risky, extremely risky, whether you're for them or not. And history has shown us that. We should not be celebrating. We should be preparing. Because regardless of what she does or says or whatever, in office, if you really do care about Indigenous women, Native women, Deb Haaland herself, you better be preparing. Because she is going to be fucked either way. She's going to be taking the hit either way. And I don't see why anyone would encourage any Native woman to put themselves in that position. Because as it is, and think about it as a logical adult, like nothing good is going to come for this, for her, and probably not for us either. We can deal with that. Can she deal with that? Because the United States is a very real enemy, and they will come for you in a very real way.
It was unfortunate to see so many nonprofits, like I said, just jump on board with that. But that's, you know, who they are. So I don't believe in any type of colonial structure. I think that, you know, a lot of these things in terms of marches and stuff like that, just, you know, we're looking at all the wrong ways to address things. And I think, you know, getting inside of an institution and change from within, I mean, we already see that already, like, manifesting and how ineffective that is within, you know, the nonprofit industrial complex. And so, you know, in terms of like begging to be seen for a government that, you know, only recognized us as citizens at like 1923 or 24 or something like that, you know, you're not going to be able to win with this system in place. And so, you know, I think that, you know, when we're talking about ways to challenge the system, marches ain't it. I'm sorry, you know, we've been marching for a while, and, you know, in terms of my people, we haven't been marching the best ways when it comes to like white supremacy or, you know, some of these things like Fort Sumter and whatnot. So trying to appease or trying to beg this colonial system, I think, is, you know, it's ineffective. We need to start taking other ways than marching. I mean, I think if you look at the March on Washington way back in the day, you know, in the 60s, they were asking for jobs and justice. You know, we're still asking for that today. And so at what point do you just, like, you know, go beyond that? You know, and just say, hey, look, I'm gonna do this, and I'm gonna make sure that this happens by any means necessary. And by, like, you know, I'm gonna feed my or I'm gonna, you know, find a way to survive with all of this. And I don't know, I just think it's a fantasy, you know. The American dream is fantasy. And so participating in it, you know, all you're doing is, you know, reinforcing how power is acquired, you know, through a colonial structure. So that's what I have to say about that.
Especially in response to, like, the notion that would we rather have, you know, somebody who's worse, somebody who's explicitly working for an industry that will facilitate further resource colonialism. And to some degree, perhaps I can address this, you know, sort of attempt to categorically shut down critique of Holland because they're indigenous women, and, you know, this sort of, like, fallacy of that then perpetuating violence against indigenous women. I think it's important to understand what oath is made when somebody takes that position, and what oath is made, one, when they, you know, Holland became a congressperson, and through their confirmation, it's an oath that presents them as an enemy of Mother Earth, because they are in allegiance, they are an alliance, they are sworn to uphold, to perpetuate and enforce colonial order, colonial laws. And that means they implicate themselves and they assume the responsibilities of the entire legacy of colonial violence. So to assume that somebody is going to undo that, you know, and one, to recognize first that by making that oath, they change their allegiance. They declare that. And that is important. That means something in our communities. That is an act of spiritual violence and dispossession. So, you know, in order to fulfill and maintain colonial domination and exploitation, colonizers shape and control the political identity of indigenous peoples. We have to be real about this strategy when we're talking about assimilation as a counterinsurgency tactic, or a counter, you know, or a genocidal tactic. And the way that these systems of oppression operate within that, you know, the native vote seeks to produce native politicians as well. So what better way to assimilate rule than with a familiar face? So the critique that we put out there regarding, you know, and Bond mentioned this a little bit, it was regarding voting is not harm reduction, is that the strategy of voting indigenous peoples into colonial power structure is an act of is not an act of decolonization. It's a fulfillment of it, you know. And we mentioned that we have a history of our people being used against us by colonial forces, as we mentioned with scouts and so forth militarily, but specifically also with the creation of tribal governments and tribal entities. They were initially formed specifically to further annihilation of our communities by establishing control of our lands and resources for the benefit of settler colonial society. And there have been many attempts to dissolve those very puppet entities that have been created. So it's a complicated analysis when we critique, like, even the critiquing the Cherokee Freedmen issue in this context. It's like, are we attacking indigenous sovereignty, or are we attacking just a fucked up dynamic of colonial violence that has displaced our people from our own power? And what do we mean by sovereignty in those terms? Are we talking about political entities that have been propped up, or are props or proxies to colonial rulers? Or are we talking about indigenous autonomy and sovereignty that's rooted in our ancestral ways and knowledge systems? You know, and I think it's important to think about the oaths, look at the alliances, and look at the what is established and pronounced when people assume these positions of power, because you know, they're in these spaces, whether it's tribal, local, regional politics, they're situated in the same colonial arrangement that benefits the ruling class. You know, politicians are concerned with rules and ruling. Police and police are concerned with, you know, enforcing those rules, and the military. Judges are focused on imprisonment. So regardless of who and on what scale, no politician can ever represent indigenous lifeways within the context of a political system that's established by colonialism. And so a less harmful form of colonial violence is a fantasy. And our assertion is that the process of undoing colonialism will not occur by voting or voting in native politicians, but our people will just be further assimilated into that process, thereby legitimizing the occupation forces. And this is what is called redwashing, right? We know what whitewashing is, we know what greenwashing is, but this is what's called redwashing, where you're bringing in, you know, indigenous faces to perpetuate the same systems of oppression.
Hey, I just wanted to jump in, and you had brought up oaths, and as a person, as an indigenous male coming from Black Mesa and everything like that, I took an oath, and you know, I was in the military, I was in the Navy, and I joined to be a SEAL, and so. You know, I got into the program and everything like that, and I started to understand a lot of these things, and I didn't like it, and so I switched over to being a search and rescue swimmer. And so I'd rather, you know, because I imagined myself, like, you know, being overseas and, you know, having somebody under the crosshairs who probably looks like me. And, you know, I made the decision to be a search and rescue swimmer because I'd rather save people than kill people. But knowing that I was a part of a system that, you know, still, you know, is oppression based upon our shores, but, you know, it extends outward now. And, you know, during those times and everything like that, I was deeply indoctrinated into white supremacy. You know, how could you not, being a part of this culture, you know, the education system? And so, you know, it's a part of all of these different aspects. And so I was, you know, it's been a learning process. And I haven't always been the best towards, you know, women, the land, my own people or anything like that. I don't know if I'll ever fully be woke. It's always a constant learning experience. And so in terms of, you know, taking oaths and things like that, you know, I took my experiences and used them, and I put them, I've merged them with direct action tactics, and that proved to be very, very successful in Standing Rock. We were running like 100% success rates against, you know, the world's greatest army, and, you know, nobody was getting incarcerated. People were coming home. And so, you know, figuring out that process, and, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about these things, and, you know, I'm always like in this constant state of like, I don't know, figuring out ways to dismantle systems, and, you know, having to look internally has been, you know, great, and a learning experience, and I'll continue to learn. So I just wanted to say that about, you know, taking oaths and things like that.
So wrapping up, Bon, I know you're connecting us to the Accomplices Not Allies and Getting Out, because we've been here for a long time.
Yeah, as we tend to usually do, which I love, but yeah, scheduling wise can be a little difficult for me. Anyway, yeah, somebody had submitted a question, and a shout out to Not Brian M8 on Instagram for submitting this question. They asked, what does an accomplice accomplish when being an accomplice in academic spaces? And I know it's not like totally related to like the whole Grammy situation, but I thought since we were already talking about it, we could answer Brian's question.
Yeah. And for those of you who don't know, I tend to ignore the Grammys. I mean, it's just an elitist music industry spectacle.
I didn't even know that happened.
Yeah. Well, so the thing is that there was a moment on stage where a hip hop artist was performing, and the song is a powerful sort of like charge addressing Black Lives Matters and the George Floyd uprisings. And they had a an activist come up on stage and basically call for accomplices, not allies. Specifically, I think, you know, what they stated was, you know, something that was like, whoa, you know, where did this come from? Like, basically they said, it's time that we demand the freedom that this land promises. We don't need allies. We need accomplices. I mean, they said some other things in there, but, you know, that sort of like obviously mm-hmm. got our attention, because that's the analysis that Indigenous Action put out back in 2014. And so there was this moment where a lot of folks, especially on social media, were like, hey, have you all read like the full zine, the original piece? Because mm-hmm. this seems very disconnected from this assertion. And it was actually interesting because Tamir Rice's mom also put the mm-hmm. activist who was reading that statement on blast too. Basically for mm-hmm. exploiting the memory of, you know, those peoples whose lives and the families that have survived the taking of their lives and exploiting them. And that's been a fracture, I guess, with Black Lives Matters as well. You know, some, you know, Afro-Indigenous and Black folks that we work with as far as radicals, you know, just call Black Lives Matters Black Lives Matters trademark. You know, they did make that distinction because there is this nonprofit co-optation and tendency towards liberal politics, as opposed to the radical militant call for freedom and dismantling white supremacy and abolishing the police state. So, yeah, that was the issue that came up during the Grammys. And there's been a lot of like attention around that piece now, thankfully, because mm-hmm. people are like, hey, y'all know where that came from, right? And part of the issue is that, you know, our concern is that this whole call for accompliceship has also been co-opted by the nonprofit industry. So we put a short statement out, and we're looking at, you know, putting something, a deeper analysis, and maybe we'll save it for another show. But, you know, that initial piece is an indictment of artificial declarations of allyship and not a prop for these kinds of woke theatrics. You know, the whole point is about like those who call for justice and freedom yet only offer solidarity on the condition that it doesn't interfere with the rewards they gain from colonization and other systems of oppression are essentially frauds. You know, there's no other way to put it. And so many, like basically what we called the ally industrial complex at the time, had pivoted after we put this analysis out and tried to co-opt the idea of essentially criminalizing, like further indicting people in meaningful ways into solidarity work that went just beyond parachuting or tokenizing and all the other things that we sort of diagnose as problematic behaviors, primarily from the white liberal assertion of allyship, which is really an identity that they were sort of using in many of the ways that some people were using that, getting back to the critique of I was at Standing Rock, you know, kind of thing. And so just addressing this is like, you know, this crew using their space on the stage, during the Grammys to call for this, you know, and just basically as this performance and this declaration of accompliceship for us ringing wrong in this context, very, very wrong. And so we just wanted to sort of like open that up for perspectives and maybe spend less time talking about accomplices, not allies, and maybe more time talking about like this sort of co-optation dynamic, the issues with the nonprofit industry, and like what some people call astroturfing as well. So I don't know if y'all want to hit on any of those points and also I'm curious as to the angle you wanted to come at this with, Bon.
Well, I guess first of all, I think it's just like hilarious, because if folks who are using, you know, the word accompliceship over, you know, allyship, and read the zine, they would see that what happened at the Grammys is exactly what we're talking about, or that was discussed in the Accomplices, not Allies piece. I mean, it's literally like exactly what they did. So it's just kind of like, God, the irony. And then, yeah, I think that is like a really good way to kind of like come full circle in terms of everything that we've been talking about, as far as like, you know, assimilation to the government, using like easily digestible language, without, you know, that deep critical analysis offered in terms of, you know, using the word accomplice over ally. It's all just like everything I feel like we've discussed, and kind of like what I'm walking away with feeling and thinking is that, you know, we're not going to reach the kind of like life that I envision for myself and my relatives and my future kin, by any of these mechanisms that we've talked about today. And so when you know, people were like, oh my gosh, like Deb Haaland, or oh my gosh, like, you know, that director, that activist who you know, co-opted the accomplice versus allies narrative, and then also you know, all these people who are using the faces and the names of Black people who are murdered by the state as a way to prop up their own platform, I guess you can say, it's a farce. And so really I just want to like reiterate so much that we need to remember that like get participating in LifeWays back, that were like, you know, original to our ways of being pre-contact, is really the only way that we're going to you know, beat these systems that have oppressed us for so long. And you know, these displays of solidarity from those who do the oppressing are just you know, really empty savior complex promises. And so this goes beyond like unlearning, unlearning of all the ways in which white supremacy and cis heteropatriarchy have been ingrained into our framework and our the ways in which we move through life and in the world. And so kind of like going, you know, wanting to address the question that was asked of us around how, you know, whether or not a so-called accomplice could do anything within an academic space. And that would be so cool if like Alex and Amra were here to answer that question, but maybe we can have them back on to address that a little bit. But funny enough, in the essay "Accomplices, Not Allies," there's actually like a literal section on academics and intellectuals, and the reading the essay asserts that an accomplice as academic would seek ways to leverage resources and material support, and or betray their institution to further liberate struggles, and an intellectual accomplice with strategies with and not for, and not be afraid to pick up a hammer. And so like, I think that's a start to the conversation around like academics and intellectuals accomplishing. But I really think that from my perspective, as I mentioned, you know, pre-recording, that, you know, I entered the academic industrial complex as like a means of survival after aging out of foster care system. But I really like think that if it were, you know, if I could address like my life in ways that I understand now, I would have not chosen the academic route. And I really like would wish that people would divest from these institutions that have stripped us of our life ways, of our ceremonies, and instilled superiority over, intellectual superiority over the ways that we've connected to, you know, our Mother Earth for a millennium, before contact. And so I don't think I am interested in activating academics and intellectuals to be using their resources or platforms, to further like so-called accompliceship. To me, it just seems like another iteration of, you know, these representational politics and these nonprofit industrial complex, you know, harm reduction attempts at, you know, doing harm reduction. And really, in a lot of ways that I've seen within specifically like indigenous, organizing, is that when an academic shows up, they're more interested in, you know, using the right word to describe what's happening, or, you know, really using what they've learned through academia and the nonprofit industrial complex, and showing up with that, and then actually just really kind of like muting or like subverting like real radical like on the ground movement into this more so intellectual debate. And so if there was an example of like an academic accomplice, then like I would just be very sus of like anyone who comes into like an organizing space that I'm part of as an academic or an intellectual. And so I think that's kind of where I'll leave it for now.
What does that even mean, an intellectual?
Like someone who's a college?
Good question. I think only intellectuals are people who call themselves that.
I feel like intellectuals, if they are to come into our spaces, they should know, if they have any goddamn sense, they should know that since they're so intellectual, they should reason that the most powerful space they could fill in our movement is not by teaching the class, is by acting like they're going to teach a class and then opening the side door, because they're the ones that can get in there to actually open the side door for the rest of us to let us do whatever the fuck we need to do.
Unfortunately, I think that the term accomplices and everything like that is now lost. I think it probably lost some sort of like,
yeah,
something that it needed to have in order to be true and genuine. Because if you look, I mean, like I worked at nonprofits for a minute, like doing all kinds of like art and stuff like that, representing some of the biggest 501c3s and everything like that. And I got to tell you, it's cannibal culture. I mean, these people take language and they commodify it, they package it, and they put it into slick advertising campaigns and replete with graphic design donations and things like that. And so we used to uphold these corporate structures, and when you look at them, the presidents of some of these folks, they're all white. The whole board is white. And so you're upholding, again, the we don't have our best, you know, our people's best interest in mind. And so having to come to terms with that, you know, I used to work on it all the time in the sense of like these different hashtags throughout the movement, you know, keep it in the ground. You know, what is it? Decolonize was popular for a while. And then like people started like, you know, utilizing that. And I think it was even like, copyrighted during COVID by an indigenous nonprofit. I mean, right there you have like a perfect example of these things. And now, you know, land back is, you know, what the fuck does that even mean? You know, it's like you're just throwing it out there, and then like there's like, you know, I see a lot of people getting arrested, and I see bank accounts like getting up into the millions. But, you know, other than that, I'm, you know, working for these institutions, you know, again, being weaponized against my own people, you know. So it comes down to clout chasing. And in terms of nonprofits and how they operate and what they do, it's just not there. That's not the answer, you know. So, I think that any nonprofit, I think if you were to test how radical they are, you know, if they ask, you know, hey, what does the community need? And you respond with guns, see what they say, see what they do. Like, oh, you know, we can't do that. You know, well, why not? Because American Indian Movement did it, you know. Well, we don't really operate, you know, we have white donors and that, you know, inhibits in our money and we got a bottom line. And so all of this stuff is like straight up colonial.
Mm-hmm. Including, you know, academic institutions. So
yes,
that's why I said it's really just like an extension of, you know, nonprofit industrial complex, like settler colonial ways of being.
Yeah, and I think that like as artists, just to interject right here, I mean, like, you know, going up against a cannibal culture, you know, wrapped up in a corporate shell. I think that, you know, as artists, we have to continue to create this language. Unfortunately, we have to develop our own language. We have to keep moving on in some way because, you know, we have to keep creating more than the, you know, capacity that society itself destroys. And so that includes a language. So, like, I don't know, you know, it's a task. It definitely is. But, we just got to keep finding ways to talk about these things. And it's an English term, too. So
that
needs to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I just wanted to jump in and just address this notion that accomplices is, you know, dead. Because I think I agree with that to some degree. But I think the analysis should be clear that the identity of accompliceship is what is dead, because it should never exist. Our critique on the ally industrial complex specifically stated that no one should proclaim that they're an accomplice, and we should be suspect of people who proclaim that, because it's actually something you do, and that's it, is what you do or what you don't do. It is only, you know, solidarity means action. It means attack. And it is only proven through that you are either with us or not in our struggles. And I think that that's the important distinction. So, you know, I actually, you know, have been amused to some degree in seeing the way that people have used that terminology to create and absorb an identity. And that's just pivoting maneuvering of the nonprofit industrial complex to absorb this critique of their structure, and then co-opt that language so that they can continue to do what they're doing. So anybody that has ever declared themselves as an accomplice, or groups that have made workshops, or all of that kind of shit, you know, like Surge showing up for racial justice, the Catalyst Project, all of these groups are actually part of the reason that we developed this critique. But here they have just co-opted, they've sort of maneuvered to use that language in the very way that we have said this is disingenuous, that this is actually what we're indicting, which to me just proves who they are. I think we should be highly critical of anybody who shows up and says they're an accomplice, that much more so, because what is the implication of that? That means, oh, you're ready to throw down and be in serious struggle with us at our sides and assume like that deeper risk that is the implication of liberation, because that's what we're talking about here. You know, that's what we mean. So we need to define, and I think that the urge that we had in writing that piece was that accompliceship is a methodology. It's not an identity. It is, it should be something that we look at and reflect upon when we choose certain tactics, right? When we develop our strategies, this should be inform our approach of relationality, of our relationships to each other. You're with us or not? And how deep are you with us? And are you here just for superficial, like you said, clout chasing, like all these issues that you mentioned, Remy, all these fucking checkboxes are exactly what people are using now to maneuver using the term accomplice, but we see them for what they are. We know who they are. It's artificial. And that's why the one thing I wanted to state regarding this whole situation with the Grammys, to me, is this, it's just activist theatrics. And whether it's coming from Surge, whether it's coming from a nonprofit or an indigenous nonprofit, it's the same dynamics. These liberals are gravitating towards any sense of authenticity that camouflages the maintenance of their privileges. You know, it's somehow lost on them that one cannot seek justice from the colonizer while simultaneously seeking to reap more rewards from colonialism or capitalism. The statement that really sort of rubbed me the wrong way was that we demand the freedom that this land promises. Well, stolen land offers no promise of freedom. This is the great historical lie of colonial invaders whose promises of freedom and democracy could only be fulfilled through genocide and slavery. This person up there on stage saying accomplices, not allies, and then we demand the freedom that this land promises. No. You know, we have to stop there and clarify what's going on. Is this that, you know, personally, from where I come from, I don't demand anything from the rulers of an empire built by stolen lives. You know, that the call for action, you know, was made at the Grammys for Biden to take action, to hold them accountable for justice, and not for the people to continue to rise up and fight for liberation, for Black Lives Matters, against police violence and white supremacy, underscores to me the insincerity and incomplete aspiration of that statement. And like they were chanting until freedom. It's like, what does that mean if you're just begging for justice from politicians that are going to maintain this colonial order, and you're saying we want the freedom that this land promises? What has it ever promised us except for violence and our non-existence? Whether it's somebody on the stage of the Grammys or somebody, you know, in the spotlight, in a movement, and we see a lot of this happening in many of our movements, from especially indigenous non-profiteers who have exploited since Standing Rock, and even at current frontline struggles, they're still, you know, benefiting themselves, and they're gripping the megaphones. They won't let it out of their hands. You know, so to me, this is just performance. Anybody who says, you know, at this day and age that they're an accomplice, I'm like, okay, what about this is performance? You know, to see this staged militant aesthetic with liberal demands before an elitist audience, you know, what does that mean? It's just a performance. So the challenge here is that an accomplice, and this is what we made very clear in that original piece, is that the accomplice would seek ways to directly challenge and unsettle power with actions that break the bonds, the laws, and social order that exists today. And that's, you can't get any more clear than that. If you're not doing that, don't come at us saying you're an ally. Don't come at us saying you're an accomplice, because you're not in the same struggle that we are for liberation.
Dang. Yes.
Yeah. I'm down with that. That's for sure. Mm-hmm.
Can we just cut out all the other stuff and then just put that in?
No, it's just like...
Can we hashtag that? Is that possible?
See, this is the thing. This is part of the reason, like, that we decided as Indigenous Action not to write a follow-up to Accomplices Not Allies, is because, like, everybody wants to have that authenticity and they want the authority on this issue to like give them a badge. They want to go through that workshop. They want to have like, you know, be woke and have that stamp, you know, on what they're doing. It's like, no, prove this shit. Be there with us in our fight and like demonstrate the commitment and the risk and the resolve. Like, because we can look at groups like the Indian Collective. We can look at groups like, you know, a whole range of other like nonprofit Indigenous entities that, you know, they use this terminology, they co-opt this terminology, but why are they there? If they weren't, would they be there without a paycheck?
Nope. Yeah. And that really fucking needs to be like disrupted too. I know, you know, over this last year, a lot of people kind of just, I think morally satisfied by the fact that their occupation had the facade of, you know, helping our movements. And so I just want to make it really clear that what you get paid to do is probably 99% likely not really contributing to what we need to see happen. And so, yeah, if you're fucking paid to get up on a stage and, you know, talk about so-called accompliceship, my guess is that you're probably not really like understanding of like the actual struggle that people on the ground are facing every day. And so, yeah, I guess
been
it's
in
just,
the streets, basically.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, when is a good accomplice ever talked? Like, that's not what a good accomplice does. They shut the fuck up.
Yes. Yeah, totally. And so, yeah, and you can't fucking be an accomplice and get paid for it. I think, like, some of the last closing thoughts that I have, you know, really go back to like the need to understand how interconnected all of our struggles are, from sexualized violence to anti-blackness, really needs to be fully understood in order to understand, like, you know, the interconnected tactics that we need to use for liberation. And I say that because, you know, we have a lot of, you know, cis men or cis assumed men who show up to space, to community, without having really a real understanding of what the root causes of sexualized violence are, you know, of course, which stems from white supremacy and cis heteropatriarchy. And so It's I think for me, something that I just still haven't really seen the needle moved on, in terms of like what you know, men are assumed to be men are doing and having these conversations around how is it our responsibility to you know, abolish what we perpetuate. So I really just kind of like wanted to touch on that, and that be like probably my final thoughts for now.
Okay. I just want to tell you guys, thanks for inviting me on, and hope to talk to you guys again soon, and stop line three.
I just think that, you know, my final thoughts on all this stuff, and I think we're saying it in the chat and everything like that, the nonprofits are inherently anti-Indigenous. These are corporate structures. You could probably contribute them to the new forts that we have to deal with right now. And we've got our own people manning them in some cases. And so these need to be burned down just like the rest of colonization. And so I just wanted to say, yeah, and thank you for your time, and appreciate it.
As we get back into the groove with Indigenous Action, we're looking forward to digging deep and having this space, a shared space, to address critical issues of Indigenous liberation. So you can find this broadcast on any of the usual podcast platforms, including now the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network, or of course at our website, indigenousaction.org.
You can also email us pictures of burning cop cars, any questions or topics you'd like to hear us go claws out on at iainfo@protonmail.com. And we'll definitely be sure to integrate your questions and ideas into this broadcast. So thank you, everybody.
Feel that fire so it's a blazing, blazing fire that they can never stop.